Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The unsung villains of the financial crisis got some attention on Capitol Hill today. The credit rating agencies, don't you know, and what financial reform might mean for them. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Citrix, offering Go to My PC, allowing users to work from anywhere via the web. More at gotomypc.com/market. And by MassMutual, offering Save the Game, a financial literacy app for children designed for iPod Touch and iPhone, available on the App Store.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Friday today, everybody, the 23rd of April, and it is good to have you with us. If you ran down the list of people or organizations who've been singled out for their role in the financial crisis, you could reasonably expect to see aggressive Wall Street bankers, absent federal regulators, and regular folk who got in over their financial heads. Not usually on that list are the ratings agencies, Moody's and Standard & Poor's and Fitch's, the ones that gave AAA grades to bonds made of mortgages not worth the paper they were printed on. A congressional hearing today aimed to put those guys on that list, Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports.
Today's hearing spotlighted glaring conflicts of interest. Democrat Carl Levin of Michigan said that credit rating agencies gave high ratings to risky investments. Levin says they didn't want to lose business from the banks that created those investments and paid for the ratings. Former Moody's investment analyst Richard Michalik told senators that some banks refused to let him rate their investments.
There was a variety of complaints that I would be either too aggressive, too abrasive.
A Senate report says Moody's and Standard & Poor's used inaccurate rating models. Later, they created new, stricter models but never applied them. Again, the report says the rating agencies didn't want to bite the hand of the bank that fed them. The financial reform legislation doesn't address this problem. Gerald Epstein wishes it would. He's an economist at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He says the bill should require that credit rating agencies be paid indirectly.
You could tax the banks and then have a general fund that would pay the credit rating agencies.
Jim Allen says he has a better idea. He helps a credit financial analyst. He says right now the government requires investors to use the ratings. Allen says change that and you take away the agency's captive market.
Make it so that they have to compete on the quality of their analyses and their continuing monitoring of these instruments.
Allen says then the rating agencies would cater more to investors. They may do that anyway. The financial reform bill lets investors sue rating agencies for the first time. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
The yield on one-year Treasury bills was less than 0.5%. Today, even 10-year notes got you less than 4%. That helps explain why investors, both big and small, have started chasing bigger returns with riskier bets. And it brings us to the rock and a hard place decision that faces the Federal Reserve next week as they meet to decide whether to bump interest rates up above zero. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon explains.
Analysts expect most monetary policymakers to support holding the line on interest rates, but there's growing pressure for the Fed to begin returning rates to more normal levels. Thomas Honig heads the Kansas City Federal Reserve Bank, and leading up to next week's meeting, he's been warning that too much easy money is what got us in this mess.
People argue about this, but I'm of the view that having an extended period of low interest rates in the early part of the decade of the 2000s, not by itself, but it was a contributing factor to the crisis that we're now working our way through. So we need to be mindful of that.
Honig spoke recently on the Fox Business Channel. At Clearview Economics, Ken Malin shares Honig's concerns. He worries the economic recovery is being built on artificial gains created by what he calls a flood of funny money.
It wants to find a home in the form of higher prices for goods and services and in the form of higher asset prices, stock prices or homes or value of bonds.
The easy money also troubles investment advisor Axel Merck, but he understands why the Fed sees a need to keep its interest rate crutch in place.
The banking system in the U.S. needs to become even healthier, and the best way to do that is for the Federal Reserve to provide very cheap money to the banking system.
Merck says he expects the Fed to promise vigilance but make no real change, and that worries the Kansas City Fed's Thomas Honig, who argues the central bank can't keep putting off a decision.
Doing nothing is a decision, and it has its own set of consequences.
I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Rising home sales beat back the prospect of rising interest rates on Wall Street today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Despite its recent primary use as a celebratory bath for winning football coaches, Gatorade has bigger dreams for itself. If you tune into the NBA playoffs tonight, you might notice athletes doing something different with it, actually drinking it. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith reports Gatorade is trying to get back in the game.
Gatorade used to be a drink for hardcore athletes, but its message has gotten a little flabby, says beverage consultant Tom Perko.
They got a little greedy. They tried to make the drink for everyone so that essentially, you didn't have to break a sweat.
But those armchair athletes moved on. And last year, Gatorade's U.S. sales dropped more than 10%. Now the deep-down body thirst quencher is regrouping. John Sisher edits Beverage Digest.
They're trying to go from being a sports drink to a sports nutrition hydration innovation company.
Translation. There are now three Gatorades for before, during, and after exercise. G Prime, G Perform, and G Recover. Ads show new types of athletes, like cheerleaders and surfers.
Gatorade. That's G.
But consultant Tom Perko is skeptical.
One of the most difficult things in marketing is to try to go backward and reclaim territory that you've given up.
Gatorade still holds about three-quarters of the sports drink market. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
It's been a week since the SEC announced those fraud charges against Goldman Sachs. In the interim, the White House has stepped up its push for Wall Street reform, and honestly, other business and financial news kind of pales in comparison. Here to do our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond, our business writer John Carney, also Felix Salmon from Reuters. It's good to talk to you both again.
Great to be here, Kai.
Thanks for having us.
All righty, gentlemen. Two little words, Goldman and Sachs. John Carney, you get first bite at the apple today. Discuss.
I think that the SEC has overstepped its bounds by bringing a suit against Goldman Sachs based on the fact that they may or may not have pulled the wool over the eyes of a German and an English bank. The SEC should be out there protecting ordinary investors, not the big boys, from each other.
So basically, these are experienced investors and tough weenie beanies?
Right. The entire U.S. securities law is actually based on that premise that the sophisticated investors fend for themselves, and the little guy is the guy who needs protection.
Felix, help me out here. I thought the charge against Goldman wasn't that, they were mean to experienced investors. I just thought it was fraud.
Absolutely. What Goldman did was they had these lies of omission, according to the SEC. There was a whole bunch of very important information about a deal that they put together, which they did not reveal to investors. And that's something which you can't get away with on Wall Street. There's nothing in the statute book about these things don't apply if the investors are sophisticated. The rules are the rules. And it seems relatively clear to me that there was very important information about this deal, which Goldman did not disclose to the key investors in the deal.
John, what about the idea that maybe Goldman has done some damage to its own reputation in that it's an investment bank, it depends on its word on the street, and now, it's a little dicey. You buy that at all?
I do. I think it's one of the reasons Goldman has come out so publicly, which we very rarely see when the SEC charges somebody with something. They don't usually issue a point-by-point rebuttal in public to the press. And Goldman is fighting for its reputation very actively because they perceive exactly what you said. There is serious damage to their reputation, and that could then hurt their business.
Had the Obama administration sketched this out on a timeline, it could not have come at a better time, Felix, for financial reform to benefit from it, right?
One would think, wouldn't one, that after all of these headlines about the skeeviness of Goldman Sachs, that no senator with any heart would ever be able to vote against financial regulatory reform. And it will go through very easily, but of course, somehow I doubt that's going to happen in reality.
Let me throw you this last question on the way out here. to paraphrase Humphrey Bogart in Casablanca, do the problems of one little investment bank, Goldman Sachs, really amount to a hill of beans when you think about Wall Street as a factor in this economy and what needs to change there for it to get back to working the way it's supposed to?
Goldman is not one little investment bank. Goldman is the single most important investment bank in the world. And if Goldman has been shown to have feet of clay and failing to disclose important information to the clients which it claims to always put first, then what that means is that no one can trust Wall Street anymore and that we have to regulate them much more than we ever thought.
John?
I think that Felix actually has it a little bit backwards in that what's really happening is there's a danger of crippling the U.S. hold on the financial business by overreacting. The derivatives business will keep on going. It may not be located on Wall Street anymore. It may be located in Hong Kong. It may be located in London, although they're doing their best to prevent that. But there will be a forum for people to do complex financial trades with each other somewhere in the world.
But John, what about the thought that goes, you know what, Wall Street just did us so wrong in this recession and the financial crisis that something has to be done?
I think there's something to be said for that. If the cost of having Wall Street on Wall Street in New York, in the United States, is that when they screw up, we have to bail them out, maybe that cost is too high.
John Carney, business writer. Felix Salmon from Reuters. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Coming up, enter Enron, stage right.
Whether you're talking about hedging or derivatives or even something, you know, really complex like credit default swaps, they tend to be based on some sort of metaphor or illusion.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials rose 69 points today, about two-thirds of 1%, closed at 11,204, the blue chips did. The NASDAQ climbed 11 points, nearly half a percent, 2530 at the bell. The S&P 500 edged up 8 points, that is two-thirds of 1%, finished at 1217. For the week gone by, the Dow put on 1.7%, the NASDAQ bolted up 2%, the S&P 500 gained 2.1%. This is, by the by, the eighth straight weekly gain for both the Dow and the NASDAQ, if you're keeping track. New home sales were through the roof in March, rising 27%. Home builders had a second straight day of gains, with Pulte up 5.2%. Lennar built up a 5% gain today. The price of crude oil gushed above $85 a barrel today. ConocoPhillips and Chevron each pumped out a nearly 2% gain. ExxonMobil up 1%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By Citrix, offering Go to My PC, allowing users to work from anywhere via the web. More at gotomypc.com/market. And by Vanguard. Vanguarding is an investment philosophy designed to help individuals reach their financial goals. Vanguard.com. Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune in to Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The Commerce Department reports on residential vacancies and homeownership for the first quarter of 2010. Meet Professors Beyond Borders. The organization officially launches at an event at the National Press Club. One of the group's first projects is rebuilding schools in Haiti. And a two-day presidential summit on entrepreneurship convenes in Washington. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. You know, there is a temptation to talk about the American economy as if it were a single monolithic thing. Truth is, that couldn't really be farther from the truth. What happens in one place doesn't necessarily happen in another. Some cities felt the recession more deeply than others did. They felt it at different times and in different ways. The bust hits Seattle, for instance, later than most of the rest of the country. Our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, is in Seattle this week, where Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports that people are still trying to figure out whether parts of the real estate market there are improving or getting worse.
The elevator descends quickly in Seattle's tallest building, the 76-story Columbia Center. The financial health of the skyscraper itself is in question, as we'll see in a minute. At least with the elevator, you know when you've reached the bottom. Developers in Seattle overbuilt. Office space is now 20% vacant. That's double what's considered healthy. Brand new condo buildings sit empty. Cindy Thomas is a lawyer specializing in commercial real estate. She says there is money out there, but it's in a holding pattern.
We have buyers standing on sidelines waiting to buy, but they want to buy at the bottom price. So everyone's waiting and standing and staring at each other. But they've been doing that for about a year now, so we're just beginning to see the thaw.
At the same time, she makes a good case that the market will get worse. Several regional banks are nearly insolvent, and if they're forced to foreclose on bad loans to raise money, the banks could dump more real estate on the market at fire sale prices. Land use economist Matthew Gardner says a little deflation was needed after real estate prices skyrocketed in recent years.
We saw prices escalate from that $500 a foot barrier to close to $1,000 a foot in about three and a half years. We're not a market that is worth $1,000 a foot, in my opinion.
What is real estate worth in Seattle? For some condos downtown, that question was answered at an auction. The prices set at an auction helped determine the value of similar condos on the market.
They achieved a value somewhere north of $400 a foot. I think Seattle is probably worth more than that, but not by very much.
In terms of construction projects, these are Seattle's lost years. The perfect example is a downtown property that was supposed to be home to a new hotel with condos. They even dug a pit 30 feet deep for the foundation. Paul Thomas with Northwest Auctions has been following the developer's progress.
As he was digging down, the condo market just evaporated out from under his feet. So they got the hole dug. It sat as a giant hole for about a year while the market continued to plummet.
Ultimately, the developer filled in the hole. The property is about to reopen as a parking lot. Landlords for existing office buildings aren't so lucky. Charles Stadiker runs a commercial real estate company.
The name of the game for the landlords today is do everything possible to keep your building as full as you can.
The landlord may lower the rent in return for locking in a longer lease. Of course, this reduces revenues for the owners, potentially pushing troubled properties over the brink. Remember Seattle's tallest building, the Columbia Center? The builder's owner recently missed a loan payment, and vacancies there are expected to hit 40% in the next year. I asked some of the current tenants if they plan to renegotiate rent or move. Bond manager George Hankey has a gorgeous view of the Puget Sound.
The comment's been made that this office is actually better than the president of the company's office, given the view.
His lease doesn't expire for a year. He says he'd have to consider cheaper rent elsewhere, but there are downsides.
Well, you get a lot of soft costs involved, changing letterhead, changing business cards.
He also knows of a company that moved out of downtown, and as a consequence, it lost about a third of its staff. From the lake, you can see about the only construction cranes still in use. Billionaire Paul Allen's company, Vulcan, is finishing a major project. Spokesperson Lori Mason Curran.
We have quite a bit of construction under development. Right now, we are completing a 1.7 million square foot headquarters for Amazon.com.
After that, Vulcan has no projects planned. Curran says Seattle development could use a couple of lost years just to get the market back to equilibrium. In Seattle, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
The more we learn about what Wall Street was doing before the financial crisis, the more it all seems vaguely familiar, like we've seen this movie before. And to a certain degree, we have. About 10 years ago, with a company called Enron, shady accounting,
hiding debts where they'd never be found, and an insatiable need for capital that eventually left Jeffrey Skilling, Andy Fastow, and Ken Lay facing time in federal prison. It's not what you might call the classic recipe for a Broadway play.
All right, wait, wait. You need capital?
Yes.
You need cash? What, one, two, three?
More like four.
$4 million I can find.
Million?
No! You need $4 billion cash?
Today, as we cover the art of money, what artists and others see when they look at the economy, playwright Lucy Prebble. She had read the stories about Enron while it was happening, but she really started paying attention when its executives went on trial a couple of years later.
And that's when it really struck me that there was something innately dramatic about the story. The way that Andy Fastow, for example, the CFO of Enron, testified against his former boss, Jeffrey Skilling, a man who he had adored and really looked up to, in order to get himself a reduced sentence. And when I was looking at those sorts of things, I thought, well, this is a story really about the relationship between these two men, and finance is part of that. But, you know, there's actually an awful lot of quite classical dramatic tragedy going on there as well.
Yeah, and the other great character, of course, is Ken Lay, this
of course,
guy who sort of sits atop this whole structure and kind of engineers the whole thing.
Well, absolutely. And I think the fascinating thing about this triangle of men, really, Skilling, Fastow and Lay, for me, was that they were such strong personalities, as people attracted to power often are. But they all also represented something different and archetypal about business. You know, Skilling's very much a visionary idealist, and Fastow kind of an amoral numbers guy. But the thing I was really fascinated with about Lay is Lay, you know, a very religious, very traditional man who really believed, or thought he believed, in integrity and ethics. And the company is something that, there to support America. And I think someone like that being drawn into and corrupted by money, I thought it was a fascinating journey.
When you sat down to write this, then, how did you conceive it? I mean, what was the thought process as you put pen to paper?
Well, originally, my first thought was, okay, well, this has to not be boring, you know, because of course
we do that every day.
Yeah, well, exactly. Of course, it's very similar in that way to how you'd think about finance journalism, isn't it? I mean, the first thought is, how do you make finance interesting and exciting? And the second thought really was, what are the human elements of this story? But the more you look into it, the more you find, I think, that behind numbers and behind finance, you know, there are always just people behaving. I mean, a marketplace itself is just a group of people acting, whether it's, you know, prices going down because of fear or prices going up because of greed. They are emotional responses, even though the outcome is somewhat numeric.
It must have been great for you to have the ability and the creativity of the stage to explain some of these things that are just bizarrely complicated.
It to me felt like quite a logical place to do it.
Yeah.
Whether you're talking about hedging or derivatives or even something, you know, really complex like credit default swaps, they tend to be based on some sort of metaphor or illusion fundamentally, i.e. they're not real things that you can take hold of and grab. And in a way, that's what we do in theatre. When you write and you put on a show, essentially you're asking people to come into a room and believe that something that is not real is real. And that's sort of how financial instruments operate in a way.
Tell me about one of my favorite devices in this show, how you personified the debt, the thing that brought Enron down, really, the debt, the off-balance sheet partnership and these raptors that you have. Tell me about those.
Andy Fastow, the CFO, he designed financial instruments called raptors. He was a big fan of sort of 90s movies, and he named them after the velociraptors in Jurassic Park.
What's that?
Nothing.
What is it?
Don't worry about it.
What the f*** is this? Oh, God! It's the raptors. You like them? They like you? That's where the debt goes? With these sort of entities?
You know, there were also things named after Death Star. There were lots of Star Wars references. But particularly the raptors I found fascinating, because when I read about that, I thought, well, how am I going to represent financial instruments that devour debt on stage? And then you find that Fastow himself called them raptors. And you think, well, I know exactly how I'm going to do that. I'm going to have dinosaurs on stage. Why not?
This play did very, very well over in London. And here you are now bringing it to the States, to Broadway. Was there any reluctance on the part of the American producers in the fact that you're obviously not from this country, and, you know, what do you know about writing this American story?
Well, I'm I'm certainly aware of that. I'm aware that I'm British telling an American story. But what I feel about it is that America is the sort of great empire of our times. And if I was living in Roman times, I'd want to write about Rome. I love America. I'm passionate about it and fascinated by it. And I think coming from the West, as I do in Britain, I'm as much a part of capitalism as anybody else is. And I just wanted to look at a story that exemplifies that, really.
Lucy Prebble and her play Enron. It opens on Broadway next week. Lucy, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai. Thank you very much.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing, online surveys, and event marketing. ConstantContact.com. By Nixon Peabody LLP, a full-service international law firm offering practical solutions for today's real-world business challenges. More at NixonPeabody.com. And by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, today it's Friday. It's been a busy week, so, you know, why don't we do this? Forget about the regular news and spend a little time on the things that didn't quite make the headlines, courtesy of Rico Galliano, Brendan Noonan, and the rest of the Marketplace staff.
Raphael Cohen, intern for the Marketplace New York Bureau, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
So in Holland, some thieves waited till some inmates from a Dutch prison were let out on furlough, and they went in and stole the TVs from their rooms.
So wait, they stole TVs from a prison?
Exactly, yeah. It's win-win, because if they get caught, they get to watch the TVs anyway.
Also, I think stealing TVs is legal like everything else in Holland.
Exactly.
So. Rada Bead, senior producer, Marketplace Morning Report. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
I'm talking about Spirit Airlines. That's the airline that last week announced that they're going to have to make you pay to bring your carry-on bags on.
Everybody's favorite airline, yes.
This week, they went about 12 steps further than that. They have new planes with these brand new seats that sit straight up. You cannot move them, and they're calling them pre-reclined seats.
That is amazing.
Pre-reclined. What can you say about that? Pre-reclined.
It's like if you go to a car dealer and he's like, no, the front of this car hasn't been crushed. It's pre-shrunk.
Stacey Vanek-Smith, senior reporter at Marketplace. What's your story this week?
Well, in my home state of Idaho, in the southeastern part of the state, the pelicans are eating a lot of fish, so they're trying to control the pelican population. So on this island where a lot of pelicans live, they've released badgers and skunks to eat the pelicans.
So it's like these fish have recruited humans to use badgers and skunks to help them survive?
Right.
It's like an affront to Darwinism.
Yeah, well, and it would make a very complicated car decal.
Or a really cute parade.
You can catch more of what Brendan and Rico have to offer in their podcast. It's called The Dinner Party Download, and there is, of course, a link on our website. It's marketplace.org. And that on this Friday afternoon is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 69 points, about 2/3 of 1%. The NASDAQ up 11 points, nearly 0.5%. The S&P 500 added 7 points. That is 2/3 of 1%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Coming up this weekend on our personal financial Marketplace Money, they go to Seattle, where landlords are desperate for good tenants.
We got a free 32-inch TV. We got like 7 months of free storage and some free 3 months of free parking. I mean, it was just, the list kept going and going. It was absolutely, it's amazing.
I need to move, man. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.